I've never had a job before, but I can assure you that I am very excited about this opportunity.
All I need is a typist who can answer the phone.
You have reached the office of Mr. Edward Gray.
It's very dull work.
I like dull work.
I'm not here.
How'd it go?
I got it.
This letter has three typing errors in it.
I'm sorry, I'm...
Type it again. This needs more sugar. Six copies of these. What is wrong with you? You can get a much bigger voice out of that tiny throat.
This is the office of Mr. E. Edward Gray.
I'm the type of guy who wants to get married and have a kid.
If you need any more typing, I can come back later.
Thank you, Miss Holloway. Good night. Come into my office.
Finally.
This isn't just about typos. It's your behavior.
What about my behavior?
It's very bad. I'm very fond of you.
I'm your secretary.
If we can fully experience pain, we can live a more meaningful life.
He's the best.
Are you doing something sexual?
There are other ways to show your feelings.
Sure, don't add more.
We can't do this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Why not? And I've found someone to love in a way that feels right.
Just a scoop of cream potatoes.
4 peas.
As much ice cream as you'd like to eat.
Could you get me a cup of coffee?
Do you really want to be my secretary?
Yes, I do.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this week to talk about the 2002 film comedy-drama Secretary, starring Maggie Gyllenhaal and James Spader, is my friend Kim Cavill. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. I'm so glad you asked me, honestly. I love gushing about this movie, and my husband's sick of hearing about it after all this time, so I'm glad to talk to somebody else.
I'm glad I could serve that purpose. Kim and I met on Twitter, and we've been having conversations back and forth. Now, Kim, you are a sex education teacher and teen pregnancy prevention specialist. So what is that exactly?
I teach comprehensive sex education classes for schools primarily in the Chicagoland area, although I'll kind of go wherever the students are, wherever the young people are. And I generally teach here in the States anyway. Now, I initially started teaching sex ed when I was living in Australia. So here, you know, those are two different ball games. Here in the States, I generally teach middle schoolers and high schoolers. So 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and up, you know. And I teach, when I say comprehensive sex education classes, that means that they're not abstinence-only sex education classes, which is, you know, a really strict kind of rubric talking about, you know, no sex outside of marriage and discouraging contraception use and trying to delay at all costs sexual activity, whereas my classes are abstinence-based, but they're not abstinence-only, which means, of course, I talk about abstinence just like I talk about any other sort of contraception, and we cover STDs, health risks, and consent, and all sorts of stuff, because even though I have my curriculum of the material that I cover, I also, every one of my classes involves an opportunity for students to ask anonymous questions. So a lot of the times young people themselves are driving kind of the conversation, and I'm more just there to facilitate and guide the discussion. So that's basically what I do. I teach comprehensive sex education classes to middle school and high school students, largely in public school. Although I do kind of private practice, I offer sex education classes, like if families are needing advice on how to have the talk with their younger children, or, you know, sometimes adults hire me to teach sex ed for, because a lot of adults have never had, you know, classes in the first place, you know, growing up. So I do that on my own time. But generally speaking, my 9-to-5 gig is sex education classes in public schools around Chicago.
Right. One of the things that caught my eye on Twitter was when you would occasionally post just the unvarnished questions you get from teens. And some of them were absolutely startling in that, you know, coming at it, of course, from a, you know, quote-unquote adult perspective, I'm like, wow, this kid doesn't know this. And you're like, well, of course they don't. Why would they know it? And I thought it was such a valuable thing to be able to say to people that are entering into this world, this part of their existence, you can ask me anything. Don't be ashamed of what you're going to, no matter how dumb it might sound, ask it, because it's important that you know it. And I've been thinking about it, and I think about the fact that, you know, I came of age before the internet, you know, all that part of my life came before the internet. And entering into the world of being a sexual person, a sexual being, was terrifying. I mean, just terrifying. And that was pre-internet. I cannot imagine being a teen nowadays and having all of the confusion and all the things that I had, but also knowing that the absolute most extreme examples of what's out there is two clicks away. I feel like the load that we are putting on teens in that arena is so massive that I thought it was just fascinating that there could be someone like you that a teen could go to anonymously and say, will this happen if I do this thing? And to have somebody with no judgment say, no, you know, that doesn't work that way. I thought that was just utterly fascinating.
Yeah. And, you know, even because I'm really careful to kind of, I have my Twitter account, but I'm kind of a ghost on Facebook, and I'm difficult to find otherwise. And so I do have my own blog and stuff like that where it's connected to its own email address. And so it's really interesting to get how I get questions. You know, I get questions face-to-face for young people who just aren't afraid to ask that, you know, straight out. But I also get all these anonymous questions. I mean, I have a massive, you know, Rubbermaid kind of tub full of these post-its from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of questions. And, you know, I catalog each one, every one of those in a database. Like, it's important for me to keep those. But I also have teens around globally who kind of stumble upon my blog and then ask me questions, you know, that they obviously don't feel comfortable asking anybody else, you know, in their life. I've got one of the most recent one I got was from a 13-year-old, and I think it was a young woman, although I always hesitate to make assumptions that way. But a 13-year-old who'd found my blog and who read the posts about teens and porn that I've written about a little bit. And she was concerned because she'd written to me, and she's been watching Pornhub for about 3 years, which is, honestly, in today's age, like, that's pretty typical. It usually starts around 10.
Oh, my Lord.
Between the age of 10 and 13. And most of the first viewing that we've just got the initial round of research coming out about this. Most of the first viewings are truly accidental. You know, young people searching for something and stumbling across this kind of content and then seeing it. And, you know, a lot of times, even if it's pretty hardcore stuff or even if it's pretty vanilla, you know, for a lot of people, young people, that first accidental viewing is kind of like a traffic accident. You know, it's kind of a weird mix of revulsion and interest. And so it's kind of compelling content, whether a person enjoys it or not. And that's usually how it starts. So, you know, she'd been watching Pornhub for about 3 years and then wrote to me because she's like, well, you know, sometimes I come across what looks to me like blatantly unconsensual porn, you know, not porn really, but more like snuff films to a certain extent. She's like, I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to do when I come across that kind of stuff. And you know, so explain to her that you can report that kind of, there's an anonymous website for the child exploitation, and then you can use it after you're the age of 13. And then, you know, I forward her some more information just on watching porn in general and in internet ethics and all this other stuff that never really gets spoken about. And so I think that's the real challenge of the job. You know, we were brought up the internet, like, that's what's hard for me, is because you still have these kind of, these typical kind of questions, like questions that I feel like I'm going to answer the rest of my life. Like, can you wear two condoms at once? And I've already told my husband, like, that's what I want on my tombstone when I'm married. Like, people, stop wearing two condoms at once, because I feel like I say it all the time and I'm never going to stop. And, you know, so I have these kind of like classics that I started answering when when I first started doing this 12 years ago, and I'm just going to keep answering. But at the same time, because of the prevalence of this kind of content and its ease of access, I also sometimes throughout the course of what doesn't amount to be very much class time, I have to try and suss out where the gaps are so I can backfill things, you know, because a lot of times, like, there's certain levels of understanding have far surpassed their foundational knowledge. So, you know, they might have seen a great deal, frankly, of anal sex, which is heavily popular in online internet pornography. But at the same time, they don't really know anything about anal sex. And so that's kind of stuff that I have to suss out and backfill in a way that also doesn't make, you know, young people in my classes who have never seen any of this kind of content and who are seriously uncomfortable, you know, not want to run, start crying and run screaming from the room. So,
right.
And a lot of times it does feel in a number of different ways, and this kind of, especially the polarized political climate, like walking a tightrope sometimes. But I mean, I started teaching teenagers because I like a challenge. So, you know, it's delivering, I guess.
It's amazing what, I mean, it's a whole separate conversation, but the idea that what teens have been doing, like the Parkland teens, this kind of amazing, you know, these kids are not afraid on social media. That's something that, I feel like that's the next generation is going to just completely usurp us old people, and that they're not afraid of being slammed on social media. You know, they're just not afraid of that. And I find that very liberating to watch, because I'm not that way. You know, if somebody makes a slight comment about one of my podcasts, I'm like, I want to run and hide, literally, you know, and yet you've got these kids being said, you know, a lot of crazy stuff out there. And so that's just remarkable. I mean, I've been reading some of your blog, by the way. It's called teaandintimacy.com. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. There's a ton of fascinating stuff there. And I said, anyone who's listening to this, a lot of you I know have kids. And some of you have kids that are just entering into the teen world. And so I would suggest you check Kim's website out. There's a lot of amazing stuff there. So, and again, the other thing that we, you know, Kim and I talked about back and forth on Twitter was movie quotes. We were just doing movie quotes back and forth. And so at one point I asked him, like, what's a good sex positive movie? And of course, you know, for some people don't really know what that term is, sex positive. You know, there are lots of movies about sex. There are lots of movies that have sex, but they're not necessarily sex positive, especially movies with women, about, you know, women enjoying sex or actually getting something out of it, and the movie is not holding them in judgment. And the movie you mentioned, among others, was, again, we talked about at the top of the show, Secretary, directed by Steven Sheinberg from 2002. And the brief plot synopsis is Lee Holloway, played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, is a troubled young woman who has just been released from a hospital due to an incident involving her cutting herself. She moves back in with her parents, Leslie Ann Warren and Stephen McHattie, but their dysfunctional relationship is troubled and features bursts of violence. Needing a job, she learns to type and gets a job working for an eccentric attorney, E. Edward Gray, James Spader. After a series of mistakes, including a flurry of typos, Gray berates Lee for unprofessional behavior, but it soon becomes clear that he is aroused by her obedient behavior, and after he confronts her about her habit of cutting herself, they embark on a BDSM relationship, which involves Gray commanding Lee to never cut herself again. And there's a lot more to this movie, but that's the basic setup. So, Kim, like, you know, how is this movie in your mind sex positive?
I think it's really interesting because largely, very broadly, the reason why I picked this movie is that it is very, very difficult to pin down as one thing or another. You know, on the one hand, there's a lot of realism in it, which is why it connects and it has such a cult following and why it had the reception it did, you know, being such a small film when it first came out. And still, particularly within, like, even the BDSM community, who unfortunately gets, you know, has to go through now on, well, I guess it's over, I think, hopefully this year with the 50 Shades of Grey thing. But, you know, every time one of those movies came out, you know, people in the BDSM community had to kind of roll their eyes and be like, no, like, that's trash. It's garbage. It's not how it is. And even though this wouldn't be what I would call like a realistic portrayal of what a BDSM relationship is, it's commonly understood, would really be like in actual life, it still connects, particularly with people in that community, and even people who are just kind of curious or outside of that community, because on the one hand, there's a lot of realism about that. That I don't ever, you know, it's hard to find in other movies, particularly as, like, if, you know, a female watcher. Like, for example, I mean, it comes down to it's little things like, you know, Lee doesn't wear a lot of makeup and she doesn't wear a lot of expensive clothes.
It looks like olive oil in some scenes.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, when she does show her underwear, they're cotton underpants, like the sort that you get at the grocery store or whatever. You know, as opposed to, if you contrast that to, like, for example, a scene in the second Fifty Shades of Grey movie when I think the young woman is getting ready for the ball. And, of course, they show her in La Perla lingerie. You know, it would cost, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. And then the next shot, she's in this gossamer silk gown, which you know that she's wearing two sets of Spanx underneath. Like, that's not what she's wearing. It's just kind of this, you know, and all of that. And this movie doesn't really feel the need to perform in that kind of way for a particular kind of gaze. So that's what I really appreciate. And then on the one hand, you know, it could be a BDSM sort of relationship, but on the other hand, it doesn't quite fit either. And so that's why I chose this movie in particular. It's just every time you try and kind of shove it into a category, it doesn't quite fit. And that's how I generally feel, especially like as a sex education teacher. And that's usually my message, particularly to high school students, is just like, you know, sex is complicated because people are complicated, you know? And so that's always been true. It's true now, and it's likely going to continue to be true. A lot of the conversations that we have, like in class or even in the larger political discourse, are really not so much about how complicated sex or people are, but how complicated we're allowing them to be in public. You know, and so that's one of the things that I really appreciate about this movie. It's just, it kind of refuses to be, to neatly fit into any sort of category, which connects to me on a really deep level, just having, you know, spending my day job talking so much about sex, because sex is messy. This movie is too, and that's why I chose it, really.
I mean, part of that, I figure, has got to be that it's because of, it stars Maggie Gyllenhaal, who is, I think, like a really underrated actress. I mean, she is always kind of doing interesting parts, and even when she kind of does something you could argue that's kind of like a money job, like she did the second Batman movie, then she brings a different energy to it than you would expect in that kind of movie. And so, I mean, I could see this part. I mean, there are scenes in this movie where, you know, James Spader puts a saddle on her, mm-hmm. and puts a carrot in her mouth, and you could see a lot of actresses not being comfortable with that material. And I will admit, the first time I saw this movie, it was right after it came to home video, so that would have been 2002, 2003. It just didn't register with me. Because, of course, my knowledge of the world of BDSM is, as you imagine, somewhat limited. And of course, if all you know about it is what you see in movies, you come away with the idea that anyone who's into this stuff, they're a bunch of freaks. You know, they're all freaks and weirdos and then people in leather hood. I mean, the Pulp Fiction guy, you know, the Gimp.
It's all
that stuff. And so when I first saw this movie, I just didn't get it. I was like, okay, what was that? I don't know. And I just put it away and forgot about it. And then when you recommended it, I thought, well, okay, I'm going to give this a second chance. And I'm always happy to do that because, you know, ideally I'm getting smarter and better and more, you know, more open-minded. And so I hope that some things will register in a different way. And this really did, because I love how, I mean, obviously we have her sympathy. She has her sympathy right from the beginning because she's a cutter. She cuts herself, and we see, you know, probably why. We see there's a scene early on where she's watching her parents, and Stephen McHattie is slapping the mother around, played by Leslie Ann Warren, and that's upsetting. And then she has this little kit, her little cutting kit, and we literally get to see her do it and poke herself with this thing. And then a later scene, she burns herself with a hot coffee pot, which is really difficult to watch. I mean, just absolutely. And you immediately realize, okay, this woman is very troubled. But when she enters into the relationship with Gray, like early on when she makes all the typos, which are very funny as James Spader gets more and more apoplectic about the typos, and then you realize that she is enjoying the attention and enjoying his wrath at her. And then she writes up a second letter where she purposely puts in typos just so he can yell at her, and then he ignores her. She puts the paper down, and she's like, aren't you going to proof it? And he's like, no, I'm busy. And you can tell she's crushed because she wants the attention. And so it's kind of, if you only pay attention to it on a surface level, you think, well, here's James Spader is sort of dominating this woman, and who wants to see that? But no, it's this is what Maggie Gyllenhaal's character wants. Yeah. She wants that attention, and that's what I would imagine makes it sex positive, because it's actually the woman who is, you know, got her hand on the rudder, as it were, in this particular relationship.
That's right. And that kind of goes back to kind of a really common misconception about BDSM relationships, you know, and aside from kind of the kinky stereotype about it, a lot of times, you know, people just kind of misunderstand and think, you know, it's one person kind of abusing or being, you know, dominating this other person. This other person doesn't really have any power, and like enjoying a feeling of powerlessness. But that's not really what this dynamic is about. There's kind of a term for this dynamic that's happening between Lee and Gray, and she's kind of topping from the bottom is normally how people would talk about that in the community. And what that means is that, you know, the person who's submissive, and Lee's definitely the submissive in the relationship, is still the one driving the car. So it's kind of, and you know, this goes back to what I was saying at the beginning, it just refuses to be nailed down. And I think that this is one thing that Maggie Gyllenhaal in particular did bring to this role, is that, you know, because she, you know, and I'm not a huge celebrity kind of follower of gossip, but I have kind of, because I fell in love with her in this film, and even in Donnie Darko, and have followed her over the years. Like, you know, she's kind of got a reputation for being quote unquote difficult, but I think that difficulty is really kind of a fierce independence. And I think that's what she brought to the role of Lee too, that there's a power in the submission when it's a choice of your own free will, and it's more than Lee's choice, it's her method of self-actualization. This movie seems to be, on the surface, about a love story between Gray and Lee, but I honestly think that that's actually the secondary plot. I think the first plot line is a love story between Lee and herself. And, you know, Gray's kind of the mechanism through which she develops the capacity to love herself for who she is and refuse to conform, which is kind of what the, you know, Peter is there for as a contrast. You have this guy, Peter, you know,
Jeremy Davies.
That's right. Who is the guy that she's supposed to be with, right? Like, just the guy that his parents want her to be with, the guy that makes the most sense. Yeah, and
they all approve of him.
And what I love too about this movie is that, you know, they don't underestimate their audience. They didn't demonize him to make it easy for the audience to be like, okay, yeah, well, she obviously shouldn't be with Peter. He's a bad guy. No, he's a great guy. He's a great guy. He's just not the kind of guy that she wants. Like, she has to make a choice, and Peter doesn't make it easy for her by just doing something terrible. Peter really likes her. He seems like a great guy. But ultimately, at the very end, Lee has to own the choice, and she has to own. She can't do that without owning who she is. And, you know, that's kind of what the climax is about, is that Lee is the person who sits in Edward Gray's chair, because she's flat out refusing to let this go. And she's the one that really has the metaphorical balls, if you will, right, to say, no, like, no, I love you. And it's that line when he says, we can't do this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And she just looks at him and she's like, why not? You know? And she's almost in that way again. She's the more powerful person because she's accepted who she's not trying to hide anymore. And so he rises to meet the occasion. And so that's why I think that, you know, it is a love story between these two characters, absolutely. But I think primarily it's also a love story, it's one of self-love. And, you know, in that way, it's almost kind of like a libertarian view, which I think that, you know, when you see Lee that's kind of sat at the desk with her hands on the desk, ordered not to move by Gray for days, and you see all those different characters through town try to come and talk to her, you know, and her dad, who's in newly found sobriety, expresses some love and empathy for her position. And then you have like that Catholic priest that comes in and says there's a long tradition, you know, of pain as a kind of catharsis and pleasure, which I thought was a really clever thing to involve. And then, you know, you have an old school kind of like feminist there who gives slides over Gloria Steinem's book and says, like, well, maybe you should read about what we struggled first. And I think that's what that line was about, is to say, like, that's not what it is about. You know, feminism isn't really about, like, oh, women hate men and, you know, women and men are the same. And that's kind of another misnomer that this movie stomps all over and makes a little aside to, because it's really about, like, having the choice to do whatever you're with your body and whatever your life, you know, with whatever you want with your life. And this is what Lee ultimately wants to do. And she's got the courage to make that choice first. And then Gray just kind of rises to meet the occasion later. You know, it has a really expansive view of relationships. It has a really expansive view of sex in general. You know, there's not actually much sex in this movie, which
no,
I also really appreciate. You know, and so there's so much to love about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's the scene where he's standing behind her and he's got her leaning over a table and he expressly says, "I'm not going to have sex with you." Like, if that's what you're worried about, I'm not going to do it. And I'm glad you mentioned the other character, the Peter character played by Jeremy Davies. First of all, when we first see him, he's dressed like a reservoir dog, which was just weird. I thought that was really interesting because, like, as you said, he's not a bad guy. He's not a jerk or abusive or anything like that, and so it makes it easy. He's just completely flummoxed as to the woman that is in front of him. And there's a moment where she kind of, after a fight with Gray, she kind of gives in and decides to take up with Peter. And they go on a date, and then they go back at one point, and they decide to have sex. And she wants to introduce a little bit of this BDSM, and he just is completely ill-equipped to do that. And you know, she's like, you know, smack me on the butt, and he can't do it because he's not comfortable with that. And I thought that was a really interesting idea that, and you could tell how frustrated she gets. She's rolling her eyes and she's like, because she needs this and he just can't deliver it. And it doesn't make him a bad guy. It's just, he's seeing something in her that's not really there, or he's seeing a different version of her than what she really is. And, you know, it's kind of funny that they have James Spader in this, because, like, when you kind of read the log line to this movie and you're like, you know, this is a woman enters into a BDSM relationship with her boss played by James Spader. You're like, well, of course it's James Spader. But then you realize when you watch this movie that if it had been a typical leading man, like a George Clooney or a Brad Pitt, you know, some real like leading man hunk guy, it might come across as he's the one doing all the dominance. Yeah. But because he's kind of weird in his own way, I mean, there's a scene where he, I guess, wants to impress her, and he's, like, doing sit-ups in his office. He's, like, quickly doing some sit-ups so he's in better shape or something. And, you know, he's just as weird as she is, but he is fascinated by her. And the scene where he insists that she never cut herself again, I think is really very powerful. And then we see her throw the cutting kit out, throw it into the river, which I thought is really beautiful. And I also love the mother, the great Leslie Ann Warren, who just, like, is not in enough movies, I think, for my taste. Yeah. And I love the scene where, you know, she's clearly has some sense of what troubles her daughter. And there's a scene where she goes out in the parking lot and the mom's just sitting there in the car. And she's like, oh, I'm here to pick you up. I'm here for 5 more hours, Mom. It's okay. Everything's fine.
She's like, I know.
It's good. And she's just, you know, because she's so worried about this little waif of her. But again, it's when you see Maggie Gyllenhaal Lee in the outfits in the beginning, like I mentioned, she's dressed like olive oil with the purple stockings and the clodhopper shoes. And when we see her show up for the interview, and she's in this purple raincoat, she's in all purple. She looks like a Little Red Riding Hood, except she's in all purple. And then when we see her for the first time, which is actually at the very beginning of the movie, it's a flash forward, and then the whole thing's a flashback, is her in, like, sort of the not BDSM gear, but she's in kind of like an office uniform, and she looks like a completely different person. She looks totally at ease and in command, and it's all because she's now sort of found herself, and it's really startling.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, and I think it's really, the visuals for this movie are just so, so wonderful for me. You know, you have, like you're talking about, the wardrobe definitely shifts, the wardrobe changes. You also have the visual of, like, pretty, she gets the job with Mr. Gray. So she gets the job, and then that night she's at home in the bath, and you know, the scenery in her room and in the house where she lives with her family, it's all done up in these really garish kind of cheap colors. There's pink and purple and these garish kind of blues. There's a lot of plastic. Her room looks like a 9-year-old's bedroom with glitter and fairies and all sorts of stuff. And that can, you know, that's even in the bathroom. And it shows her sitting in the tub and she's kind of surrounded by these fairy glitter snow globes, you know. And so she's sitting in the bathtub talking to herself because she's happy she's got this job. And she looks at this snow globe and then she kind of throws it in the trash. And so I just think even visually, every time she's in her house, you know, there's this one set of little girlish, garish sort of colors, and which feels very much like a performance. You know, I mean, even her cutting kit is a purple, glittery, fairy themed sort of thing, because her emotional life is fairly stunted. And then, you know, she walks into the office and the office is deep, rich jewel tones and a lot of natural wood. And then that hallway from where she sits all the way to Gray's office is lined with plants and natural plants. And then she gets into his office and he spends all this time and attention looking over these incredibly delicate orchids, which I think is just another visual metaphor. You have this weird guy who admits, you know, makes himself vulnerable before, so that she feels vulnerable talking about her cutting. You know, he admits that he's shy first, and it's difficult for him to relate to people. But, you know, even there, he puts all this time and attention into what's a really rare, delicate, needy sort of a flower. And so there's just little details like that worked in through the film that I really love and I appreciate. And just kind of, as I said before, like, just as a woman, I'm always happy anytime I see a person, like a female on screen, that's not a size zero, which with, you know, blonde hair and Botox lips. I appreciate when I see a more realistic figure. I appreciate when I see somebody who doesn't have a lot of makeup on or has messy hair, you know, and I appreciate somebody in actual underpants, you know, like I appreciate all this stuff. I really appreciate the scene where Lee's masturbating. You know, I really appreciate the scene where Lee's masturbating, because I remember reading a couple of interviews, because I fell in love with this movie when I first saw it. I remember reading a couple of interviews with her, and, you know, how we were talking about, I think Maggie must have brought quite a lot to the role. And I think that there's a decent amount of evidence of that. Like, I think I remember, if I'm not mistaken, her saying that scene was originally written that she would masturbate, like, kind of in the bathroom, like on the toilet. And I guess Maggie looked at the director and she said, you know, that's not gonna work, like, that's not how it is. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're like, oh, really? You know, and she's like, no. And she's like, we're gonna do it this way. And so, you know, that comes back to another reason why I picked it, is that you very rarely see anything even remotely touching an accurate depiction of female-centered pleasure in any kind of in TV or movies. So even, you know, I love that about this movie too, is that it's not just about Gray's kind of gratification, it's Lee's too. And then there are a few scenes, you know, where she's shown masturbating herself, and you never get to see that kind of stuff on screen, and especially done the way that they did it in that movie, which, you know, it's an expansive movie, and it just refuses to be pinned down as any one thing.
Yeah, if you follow this stuff closely, there are lots of examples of, like, the MPAA giving a movie, like an NC-17, like, I think that movie with Michelle Williams, Blue Sunshine.
Yeah.
And they gave it an NC-17 solely because there was a scene of Ryan Gosling performing oral sex on Michelle Williams, and that just sent all these blue hairs into a frenzy. And it's like, well, what, you know, how many, my God, movies are littered with that, with the reverse.
Exactly.
But yet, you know, if there's a scene of a woman getting pleasure from a man and it's not in a the man dominating the woman kind of way, it's like, oh, we have to hide this from America, for Pete's sake. There is something I wanted to get back to, though, when you mentioned all the detail, because this is based on a short story. I've never read it. It's by Mary Gateskill. It's called, in a book called Bad Behavior. And apparently, that story is a lot darker. Like,
just, yes.
Have you read it?
Yeah, yeah, okay. A long time ago, you know, but yes, yeah.
Okay.
No, it's very different, and it is a lot darker, and it is a straight up, like, abusive, coercive experience,
okay,
where this person is dominated, didn't choose it, doesn't enjoy it, you know.
Oh, wow.
And then,
okay, that's,
yeah,
a big
and
difference.
So
jeez.
I mean, I think it would be an interesting question or conversation to ask, you know, not just the director, but, you know, kind of the writer, how you read that story and you're thinking, I mean, I guess, you know, thought, well, what happens if this works out a different way? I don't know. I know that it was a long process to get this movie made because,
I can imagine.
Yeah, a really long process, not just for, you know, I mean, the reasons that you would expect, I mean, a small movie and then about this kind of subject matter, but because about the ending. Like, every time they got close to funding, the funding was linked with, you know, the funding linked with a demand to change the ending so that they might end up together, but it would be a vanilla relationship and they both not do any of this anymore.
Oh,
and they'd just
wow.
be normal.
Oh, yeah,
and so,
be normal.
Yeah, they have to just be normal. And so this was, they got close several times making this movie, but every time they came up to that wall, and every time, I forgot the director's name, but every time.
Stephen,
you know,
Chamber.
Yeah, that's right. Every time he just said, well, no, I'm not doing it that way. You know, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not going to compromise on this.
Yeah, if you look through his filmography, he did Fur, the Diane Arbus,
yeah,
biopic, and there's another movie of his that from the screenshot you see on IMDb is about someone who is deformed. So he's clearly someone who is interested in sort of people at the margins of what we sort of consider polite society. I mean, it's kind of interesting. He's only done a handful of movies, but that really is interesting to take that basic story and then flip it on its head. And just say, no, we're going to do a different. But the thing I wanted to mention specifically, when you mentioned the set detail, and I couldn't get a close-up of this because there is no close-up, but there's a scene where she's at her, I think, like, her table and in her bedroom, and we see a little figurine, and I swear, I think it's a ballerina. And,
yes.
And it made me think, well, ballerinas are people, are women who subject themselves to a lot of physical torment to achieve a certain end. I mean, we've heard about that of ballerinas whose, like, feet are deformed because they have to fit themselves into this mold. And so I thought that was such a great little, and there's no close-up of it. You have to kind of just notice it.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great detail that, of course, she would kind of relate to a ballerina because they're used to kind of hurting themselves in an obtuse sort of way.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, they suffer for their pleasure,
yep,
really. And so you have, you know, I'm so glad you brought that up because, you know, you have that one scene towards the beginning, because there are a couple of scenes where you do see her cut herself and, you know, burn herself, but there are a couple of close calls, too, where she's obviously trying not to, especially, you know, having gotten home from the mental institution where she doesn't want to go back to. You know, she really wants to cut herself, and she's trying to resist the temptation. And then another time she comes close to Gray catching her, and, you know, this is something that's insanely private. She doesn't want anybody to know that she's doing this, particularly him. But there's one scene at her house where I think it's almost even at the wedding. It's right towards the beginning where something's happened with her dad. I think he started drinking again, and she knows what that means.
Yeah.
And so she goes up to her room, and she gets her kit, and she lines her stuff up. And I'm bringing this up because one of the figures that she cuts herself with is a ballerina. And
oh, wow. I didn't even notice that. Wow.
Yeah, so she has a sanding block of wood, and you see her take the ballerina out, and she actually stabs herself. And you can see that this is a habit. She's done this many times before. She stabs herself with the foot of the ballerina
that she sharpens
on a block of wood. So you see her running the foot, sanding it down to make it extra sharp, and she presses it against her thigh, and you can see her, and then ultimately she pulls herself back. You know, she's like, no, I'm not going to do this, and she zips everything back up. But I'm glad you brought that up, because those little details are just dropped in like gems kind of through the movie.
I can't believe I missed that. That's a ballerina is the thing that she actually uses. Oh, wow. I'm going to have to rewatch that part because that blew right by me. That's amazing. Again, I love all the color schemes that you mentioned, all the kind of weird purples. And the office that Gray has is the most improbable lawyer's office in history. He's got so many more rooms than he needs for just one guy in there. But I love the way she handles the kit. She handles the kit without even looking at it like a soldier field stripping a rifle. Like, she's just so familiar with it, she doesn't even have to look at it, and it all just comes out in this kind of, like, regimented way, and it's sort of terrifying, because she's she's used it that many times.
Yeah, there's just so much I love about it, you know, and, you know, so the criticism, and it does show its age just a little bit in the fact that, you know, they're normal, so if we're talking about more, like, realistic sort of criticism is that, you know, normally with these sorts of relationships, you know, a successful BDSM relationships require two things in heaps. They require excellent communication skills. You have to be really, really good at communicating with your partner. And they require a high degree of honesty. And not just honesty with your partner, but honesty with yourself. You know, it's a lot of courage. It takes guts to be that honest. And so, you know, BDSM relationships that don't have those two things don't work very well. And so, you know, in real life, there would be more explicit conversations about, you know, safe words and what's a red line and what isn't. And this would normally be a routine part of, having these conversations, but at the same time, it shows its age just a little bit with that. But I think, you know, it's also like I went back to, you know, my original point is that it you can't really nail it down as one way or the other. At the same time, it's still sort of a fantasy too, so it's not a hyper realistic movie. And, you know, I think demonstrated by that scene where James Spader, where Gray talks to Lee about her cutting. And before he orders her never to do it again, of course, you know, he asks her, why do you cut yourself? And she can't answer. You know, she doesn't know. And that's what she says. She's like, I don't know. And he answers for her. And he answers in such a simple, succinct way that it really moves her. You can see it on her face. And she says, wow, yeah, that's a way to put it. And so, you know, there's some of that romance, you know, cliche in this movie too, and that these lovers are implicitly kind of connected, and, you know, that's a typical cliche in most romantic films. The lovers have an intimate connection from the beginning. And so I think it's demonstrated there, thus kind of wheedling out the reason, like, you don't need these conversations about what is and isn't okay because they just understand one another. And so, you know, in that kind of way, it's a fantasy. But, I mean, that's really the only sort of criticism that, you know, I had or I've ever heard anyone really level against this movie, just because it's so beautifully done and it's just so different.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I had wished that the Leslie Ann Warren character had been given a little more space because she seems I think the movie kind of plays her for laughs a little bit because she's so kind of brittle and almost what's that makeup, the thing where women sell makeup door to door? I'm blanking on
that. Oh, yeah, yeah, like the Mary Kay.
And, you know, when you see that what she's putting up with, that she's got a husband who drinks and beats her, and she's got a daughter that cuts herself, well, of course this poor woman is going to be pretty brittle. And you know, it's a movie that's, it's about almost 2 hours, and it only has so much time to layer all this in. I mean, the Lee and Gray don't enter into the relationship until the movie's halfway over.
Yeah.
I mean, they really have to layer it in. So I can't be too critical that Leslie Ann Warren didn't get more to do, but I wish that she had been given just maybe a scene or two where we could get a little better way of knowing her, because she's got to have a really difficult life. But that's a very minor criticism.
Yeah, and they had, you know, they did kind of have an opportunity there that I think you're right. I don't think they really took advantage of that kind of, you know, because dad, you know, Lee's dad drinks, slaps mom around, and it gets to the point where I think, you know, there's been an ultimatum, and he's just, he wants to keep, and so he goes missing. You know, he's wandering the streets for a while.
Yep.
And, you know, he calls Lee, and then she talks to him for just a little bit, and then he's gone again. And that's obviously, I mean, that's that's terrible. And so he's just radio silent. Nobody really knows where he is. And then, of course, the next time he shows up, well, he's at the hospital.
Right.
You know, and there's that moment where you're seeing the sister who never, I think she has maybe two lines the entire movie. And then, you know, Leslie Mann, and then Leslie, the mom, and then you have Lee, and they're just kind of staring there at dad through the hospital window. And I think that was a missed opportunity to have a conversation like that. Instead, you know, Lee just kind of runs away and runs over to Gray's house where, I mean, he does, he shuts the door in her face, you know, So I think that, yeah, you're right. There was a missed opportunity there. It would have added yet even another dimension, I think,
yeah,
to the relationship.
I mean, plus I just really like Leslie Ann Warren, and I'm happy to see her in movies. And so I'm like, I want to give her more to do. It's funny, the whole final sequence where she finally realizes that she can't be with Peter, and she runs out. She does a whole reverse graduate thing where she runs away to go be with Gray. And then their whole extended sort of romantic / sex scene is astonishing because it is, I mean, if you remove the whole, you know, BDSM angle to it, it really is like something out of a romantic novel, because he is absolutely worshiping her. He bathes her. And she's fully nude throughout the whole part, which, again, I always find incredibly brave of any actor to do because of just the, you know, that takes the bravery that takes to do it. But that whole sequence where they begin to start making love, and then he absolutely becomes in his own way, like his slave to her, because he's just worshiping her at every moment, and she's narrating that whole sequence, and it's really quite startling. And you know, Maggie Gyllenhaal, you mentioned you liked seeing somebody in a movie who isn't like a typical size zero blonde. Maggie Gyllenhaal is not your typical looking movie star actress, and yet she, I find, is really good at conveying desire, and that's hard. I mean, you can see sex in movies all the time where characters want to just, you know, hump each other, but she conveys a lust with just the kind of look and the way her face gets flushed that is really pretty remarkable. And again, I have to just figure that's her. That's all her being able to convey that. And I think it's really startling.
Yeah. I mean, I think even, you know, the closing shot of her is, you know, they've been married and he goes off to work and she's just put a roach on his bed, you know, on purpose. You know, and so again, we go back to, you know, they've been married, they're in this relationship. And then she does say, like her character says, you know, our weird life kind of, you know, whittled down into a routine that made us look normal to any other couple you'd see. And they're making the bed together, and she straightens his tie, and then he drives off to work. She's kind of sitting with her feet up on the porch and waves goodbye. This is right after she put a dead roach on his bed, knowing what kind of response that's obviously going to instigate. Obviously, he has a thing about, disgust, feeling disgusted. So she's kind of, we're back to, she's still driving the bus, really, of this relationship. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She's still topping from the bottom. And then she says, you know, I finally found someone to play with and a way to love that feels right for me. And then she turns and looks at the camera, and that's the closing shot. Yeah, and it's not a smile, and it's not a frown. It's just an unabashed, it's hard to describe the expression on her face, but it's just, it's a gorgeous closing shot.
I really was like, whoa, because I find that when you break the fourth wall like that, you have to really be confident of the story you're telling, because that's swinging for the fences to break that. I mean, this movie is cartoonish in a lot of ways, and we talked about the sets and the coloring and a lot of stuff, but it's a realistic movie for the most part. It's not meant to be a cartoon, and for her to immediately then acknowledge, we're in a movie, I'm talking to you, the audience, that's a gutsy move for Shane Berg or whoever it was that came up with it. And I was like, wow. And I'd completely forgotten that shot when I saw it the first time. So seeing it the second time, it was like seeing it, you know, brand new. Yeah. And I was like, whoa. I thought it was a perfect way to, and again, the movie ends with, it opens with her and it ends with her. Not so much Gray. It's all about her, which again, I think is, she carries it.
That's right. And, you know, I had mentioned that point, like, you see her in the bath after she got the job, and it's in this garish pink bathtub with, like, a glitter crystal snowball. And then, you know, then you see her in a bath at the end, you know, where it's just a completely different, you know, she looks like a completely different person with a completely different mood. And so it's just, it's a, it's a real growth of the character, and it's just there's so much I love about it.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, and this is not so much about the movie itself, but the marketing of the movie, where this show, I think you know where I'm going with this. I open the show every episode with the audio from the trailer. And so I go to YouTube and I try and find the trailer. And I was like, oh, there's a couple different Secretary trailers. And I try to go for the shorter one. So I play the shorter one and I'm like, what am I watching?
What is this trailer?
And I realized that this movie has been, I guess, remarketed by Lionsgate, whoever owns it on the home video form, in the wake of 50 Shades of Grey, to make it sound like this is another version of that story. And there's even a DVD cover of this movie where it's Secretary, but it's all in black and white, and it's got and it's like, meet the original Mr. Grey. And
I'm
like,
my God.
What the hell is this?
Oh, that's so bad.
Oh, my God. And then, I guess the idea is you're just going to get people's money. Who cares if you piss them off later?
Because I know,
I think,
right?
If you like the 50 Shades movies and then you watch this, you're going to be pretty mad, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's not what it's a whole different thing. Yeah, you're going to be a little bit upset. You're going to want your money back, I think.
Yeah, but my God. I was like, oh, come on, guys.
I know. And even even the original, the poster, where it's Lee looking at her from behind, where she's kind of bent over grabbing her ankles. I mean, I was like, really? Of all of the shots that you could have picked, like, that's what you're going to go with?
Right.
And if I remember right again, because I'd read, followed her a few interviews about the movie when she did press when it first came out. I remember Maggie saying, yeah, it was stupid and sexist too. Mm. She was like, I hate the poster. I tried to talk them out of it and I lost that one. It was stupid.
The main one that you see on the IMDb page makes it look like an old-timey pulp cover, which,
right,
I think is actually much more, first of all, it's beautiful looking. It looks like kind of like the Pulp Fiction cover with the creases and all the stuff on it. But it also, to me, it much better conveys the tone of the film that you're about to see. It's a shame that one isn't probably the one that's, I bet if you go to Amazon to rent this, that's not the one you're going to see.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Star Wars, the story of a boy and a girl, and you're like, a brother and sister. No, that's not what it's about. Like, come on, let me do it over here. Something else I wanted to ask you about, and you mentioned it a while ago about, that you don't see the scenes where Lee masturbates to the thought of Grey, and you're like, you don't see things like that in movies. And I have to assume that the reason we see so few sex-positive movies, at least where the women are enjoying sex, is because most TV and movies are written by men. I'm assuming that to a lot of men is either downright frightening, or at the very least just so unknown to them that they don't know how to write it.
Yeah. I think it's a combination. Yeah, it's a combination of both. And, it's interesting because it's not even just in this particular sector in media representation. I mean, it's even in – you can find this disparity in scientific research. There's so much more funding and so many more studies done and being done about male pleasure. And a third of the amount that's ever done about, the science of female orgasm or female sexual pleasure or arousal patterns. There's just, it's kind of a blank, it's across the board. And, I would say, of course, a lot of times you see this general theme because, you still don't have a lot of women at the table, in the group of people that's making those kind of decisions about which studies are getting funded,
right,
and which movies are getting made and who's going to sit behind the camera and who's going to work the camera, all this kind of stuff. And so, I think it's definitely a combination of both. When people sit down to write, it's like, well, I don't even know where to start. Like, what is this even like? I don't really know what it even looks like. And so then, kind of Hollywood in general just kind of churns out different versions of the same sex scene over and over and over again. There was one of the, I saw on Twitter like a couple of months ago, somebody was saying, quote tweet with the thing that annoys you the most about movies. And I was like, well, 40 seconds of penetration penetrative sex that results in a female orgasm. I mean, that pisses me off. You know, it's just constant. It's, you know, constant over and over and over again. And I got a good response because, you know, that annoys a lot of people. Not just me. You know, and I'm not making the argument that there's a lot of things about sex that aren't really realistic. You know, your average, as if we're just going on stats, your average sexual encounter here in the States lasts about 7 minutes. And when I tell that to high school students, they always get this shocked look on their face because, you know, they think it goes on and on and on. You know, like people sing about in pop songs, like have sex all night. It's like people don't actually do that. Right? Like that's not really how it goes.
We're not all Sting who's going on for 5 hours. It's, it's a lot shorter than
that. I mean, like, you know, like just generally, and then I'll say, well, you know, I mean, generally speaking, the average sexual encounters, really, when we're talking about penetrators, is about 7 minutes. And kids are like, oh, really? Well, that doesn't sound as great when you put it like, when you put it like that. But if we're talking about a movie, there's not a lot of people that want to sit and watch a sex scene go on for even 3 minutes at a time.
Right,
so I'm not
right.
saying that, you know, I mean, just to make a movie, you know, most sex scenes are pretty short. And so when you're thinking about it like that, there's, you know, it is, of course, going to follow the same kind of pattern of, you know, 30 seconds of, you know, penetrative sex, and then both people have an orgasm.
Right.
And so it's just, it's unrealistic in a broad view, but it's completely unrealistic, especially for women.
Yeah, we have a recurring joke here around the house where we'll be watching something on Netflix, some TV show, and if I catch a line of dialogue from a woman character that I would feel no woman would ever say, I always just say, written by a man. You know, because you just know that no woman would ever say that particular thing. And like, that's only because a male writer was writing the female character. And it's funny when you talk about the whole science part of it, because clearly a couple of years ago, you know, we had an epidemic of this country in this country of men losing their boners. And it was like, drop everything, boys. We have to solve this. Forget the cancer research. We have to.
It's a total emergency. We got to fix this problem.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Somebody pull the fire alarm. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. All the guys in their lab coats running down the hallway. And, you know, awooga, awooga. You know, we have to make sure we figure all this out. I mean, sort of related to that, I remembered there's a show on, it's on Netflix now. It's called, it's an Australian mystery show called Miss Fisher's Mystery.
I love
You've seen the
that
show. Okay.
Show. I adore that show.
We started watching it just kind of offhanded because we're like, oh, okay, it seems a little, this looks like fun. And one of the things that really startled me about that show was how sex positive it is in regards to the main character, because she is this young woman. She's fabulous. She looks gorgeous. Got that black bob haircut. She just looks like a million bucks. And because she's single, occasionally she will bed down the character that she runs into in the show. And the first or second time they did it, and it wasn't a plot device, I was like, wow, this show's actually doing that. Of course this woman would do this. She's young, she's full of energy, she's kind of a rebel rouser, and she's constantly surrounded by these beautiful men. Why wouldn't she do this? And I thought it just seemed revolutionary that they would put that in a show.
Yeah, and, you know, in later seasons even, there are a couple of times where various other characters kind of make, you know, male characters make a comment or two about that. And her response is fascinating, you know, there too. Because it's like, it's not, she never kind of, you know, to start screaming, you know, and it's not that kind of thing. She, you know, she just kind of looks and says, you know, if I were a man, you wouldn't be having this conversation with me. I don't owe you an apology. You know, I don't owe you anything at all. And then she just kind of smiles and moves on with her day. There's another wonderful episode. I think it's in the third season where, there's a murder, you know, most of the time there's a crime that she's a private detective. And so there's a murder at, it's not an institution, but kind of a house for women who are suffering from hysteria, you know, the catch-all hysteria term, and being treated by this doctor. And so, of course, one of the treatments for female hysteria was, I mean, that's how the vibrator was invented.
Didn't Maggie Gyllenhaal star in a movie about that very thing?
Yes,
it all comes back to Maggie Gyllenhaal.
And so in this and this woman died because the device actually shorted out, and she had a, you know, so she was electrocuted.
Dear
and so
God.
She died, and you see this, you know, and so, she, you know, Franny's going to solve the mystery, and she has her friend, Dr. Mack, who I love. She's my favorite character in the whole, you know, she's a lesbian gynecologist, and so she comes in to do the autopsy and look, and they're talking about this, and they, you know, Dr. Mack and Franny kind of figure out what had happened to this person. But Jack, that very straight-laced detective who Franny has a good relationship with, is also there, who, you know, he's going to – and so they're trying to have this conversation knowing that Jack doesn't really understand what they're talking about at all. And they're trying to be delicate. And they kind of imply, like, okay, well, it's a massaging device applied to certain – delicate areas, and you can see the look on his face where he gets it, and he's like, oh, you know? There's another device where she has a diaphragm, so she's actually using contraception too. Yeah, so her maid Dot, that strict Catholic that works for her, finds this, and she's like, what is this? She was like, a wonderful little device, and talks about it as a diaphragm, then Dot, you know, puts it away. And so it's a very subversive show in a really wonderful way. I love it. I love that show. Obviously.
It is really, yeah, buried in this kind of formula. Not, I don't mean that in an insulting
yeah.
way, but it's a mystery show. You know, you're not
yeah.
expecting that, and there it is, Miss Fisher's, and, you know, she's dead. She's terrific. That show's really terrific. So
yeah, I mean, I guess that's like other sex positive representations for sure. Miss Fisher would be, you know, top on the list. Absolutely.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Like, what other movies would you, if people listening to this would want to see other movies that are kind of maybe not, you know, necessarily something involving the BDSM world, but
yeah.
movies that are sex positive, do you have others that you would recommend?
Yeah, especially for listeners who want to maybe start a conversation with their teen and feel awkward and don't know how. There's two tips. One, I always say for parents and for teens, talk about stuff when you're in the car. No one can get out. You're kind of locked in, and you don't have to look at each other.
Right, not face to face. Right,
right, right. It really helps. It really helps, and especially if you strategically pick, like, okay, we're going to the grocery store. I know that's 15 minutes away, so we're going to endure this, you know, 15 minute awkwardness, and then we can get out at the grocery store and pretend that it never happened.
So I'm right, like, you know, have a talk. Let's go get some mac and cheese and corn.
Exactly. Chip. Exactly. Like, okay. And then it's over. And so, you know, that's my number one tip. But my second tip is to like watch a movie or, you know, one that can be a conversation starter. And, you know, most movies, as we kind of already discussed, really aren't, except for examples of what sucks, you know,
right,
what not to do. So my recommendations would be, aside from Miss Fisher, which is, you know, it's an investment because it's a TV show. I love Love and Basketball, which is an older, and it's a romance movie, but it's so great. It's about two neighbors, boy and a girl. They grow up together in the same house. They both love basketball. So the girl plays on the female team. The guy plays on the guy's team. They both get college scholarships to play, but they love playing basketball, and they end up kind of having an off an on-again relationship, but there is a scene there about midway through where he's had sex before, but she hasn't. So she's going to lose her virginity. They decide to sleep together, and it's done in such a beautiful way. It's romantic, but it's realistic. You can see that, you know, as they get undressed, she looks nervous, and she's not sure what to say, but she's also excited, and he actually uses a condom, which you never see. You never
no,
get to see that. And
no.
It's not awkward. It's just part of, and it's just beautifully done. So Love and Basketball is great. For a more recent one, I love The Incredible Jessica James, which is a Netflix film. That is wonderful too. The love story is kind of plays second fiddle too. It's just kind of a comedy drama about the main character, Jessica James. And, she ends up having this relationship with Chris Dowd, and it's hilarious, you know. And so
The woman from The Daily Show. We watched that.
Right.
We thought that was a terrific movie.
Yeah, and there's a love scene there too, which is really sex positive, and it's really, really great. I actually like Bridesmaids too, because you have that hilarious scene with John Hamm at the beginning, which is just a wonderful depiction of terrible sex, which honestly, I mean, you know, as I try to tell students, you know, we go through, when I go through my classes, like people have sex, you know, what are some reasons people have sex, you know, and then we come up with this really big list, or some, are all these good reasons, or all these bad reasons? No, it's a real mix. And, you know, we come back to this over and over and over again, that consent really is, you know, there's a misnomer about consent, that if you have consent, then all consensual sex must be great sex because you had consent. But, you know, I kind of flip that on its head. I'm like, consent is just the gateway. It's just the beginning of the conversation. You know, so it's just the entrance fee. So you have consent, but then you have to have, then you have to work for the good sex on top of that. And that requires communication, and that requires all these other things. And Bridesmaids is a really good example, because you've got, you know, with John Hamm, which is just terrible sex of people who can't communicate together at all, want two different things, are really not interested in one another as partners. And then you have, of course, the relationship that develops over the movie, and there is a love scene there too that's just contrasted. So I like that one too. And then there's this little indie film that I also like called The Pretty One, with Jake Johnson and Zoe Kazan.
Zoe Kazan, sure, yeah.
And so it's this time, and it's a weird little film, because she actually plays, without trying to ruin it, she plays a set of identical twins. And through this very, very strange kind of accident, she kind of switches place. They kind of switch places, I'll put it that way. And so the shyer sister swaps places with the more extroverted sister, who happens to live right next door to Jake Johnson. And so then they develop a relationship. But, of course, you know, there's kind of a level of deception there. She's not telling the truth. And the relationship there that develops is also really, really good, too. There is kind of a sex scene that's really sex positive, and then there's kind of a discussion at the end where Zoe's character has to apologize to Jake Johnson's character. It's kind of a reversal of, like, the, you know, the guy at the end that realized he made a mistake. He has to come back through, you know, he's running through the airport gate because he wants her back. You know? And in this case, it's Zoe's character that's just trying to get him to open the door, because he won't even open the door, so that she can say, look, I'm sorry, I really screwed up, but I still really like you. You know? So I really like that too. And then I would say for younger, for preteens, another show that's really good to watch with a lot of good material in there that can be turned into good conversations for younger teens would be Shadowhunters on the Freeform Network.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's a kind of a fantasy show about demons and angelic hunters and vampires, and it's not like that garbage fire Twilight. It's a decent show, but, you know, the characters have various romantic relationships in there. There's a wonderful love scene between two gay characters, which you hardly ever get to see, two men. It's done beautifully, as romantically as any other sort of, you know, love scene. Now, this is Freeform, so it's not explicit at all, but you just see lots of different examples of different relationships. And there's, you know, for example, there's one character who's dating a guy who finds out that she's slept with other people before him. And, you know, he's like, they're talking about it afterwards, a bit awkward. And he's like, you don't have to apologize to me. And she kind of looks at him. She's like, I wasn't going to, you know? And so there's little bits like that in the show that are also good for, especially for younger teens to talk to, for parents who are looking for conversation starters.
Outstanding. Well, I said, the last one was unexpected. I've seen clips from that show, and that seems like something teens might already be watching. So that's a good, I mean, that whole channel is devoted to sort of the teen audience. So, that's fantastic, Kim. And, I am just a, even though I don't have kids, and so this is not something I really have to be concerned about. And I am so impressed with the stuff you're doing, because I just think that, again, the burden that we place on teens now and kids with sex is so overwhelming that, you know, anybody that gives them an opportunity to, you know, ask and learn in a sort of a judgment-free place, that's a great thing, because that's how else are you going to navigate this kind of thing, you know? So
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So, well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I had so much fun talking with you about this movie. I'm really glad that, thanks to you, I had a chance to rewatch it, because it's one of those things where, you know, like I said, I didn't appreciate it the first time I saw it, and then I watched it, I go, this is a great movie. And so,
oh my God, me too. As soon as I told my husband, I was like, I get to watch The Secretary for a podcast. He's like, oh, great. Because I watch it, you know, I've seen seen it so many times. I mean, he's happy, he likes it too, but he's like, okay, this is what time number 19?
Right,
he was like, look, I'm going to go bowling. You have
perfect,
a good time.
Perfect. So, yeah.
So I'm glad for the excuse. It's so nice to talk to you too. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. And again, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter, just under my regular name, Kim Cavill, Sex, Pause, Parenting. And then I'm also at my website, teenintimacy.com. So I'm there too.
All right. And of course, everybody, if you want to find back episodes of the show, come to our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we always are talking about movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. And I always end the show with saying, that's a wrap. And I'm like so tempted to like, in the theme of the movie, say like, that's a wrap on the butt or something. But I'm not going to do that. That's very unclassy. So I'm just going to say, thanks, everybody. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Lee, I want to be frank with you. No, I know I'm your employer and we have a prescribed relationship. But you really should feel free to discuss your problems with me.
Oh.
What's going on with the sewing kit and the Band-Aids? Lee?
I feel...
shy. Do you want some hot chocolate?
Okay.
Why do you cut yourself, Lee?
I don't know.
Is it that sometimes the pain inside has to come to the surface, and when you see evidence of the pain inside, you finally know you are really here? Then when you watch the wound heal, it's comforting, isn't it?
That's a way to put it.
I'm going to tell you something, Lee. Are you ready to listen?
Yes.
Are you listening? You will never, ever cut yourself again. Do you understand? Have I made that perfectly clear? You're over that now.